Hello, everyone. This is Space Cafe Podcast, and I am Marcus. Hey, what's up, beautiful space nerds? I have a little intro for you that has nothing to do with our guest today, but I don't want to keep it from you because I find it way too exciting. A few years ago, I met this guy who I'm sure won't remember me today. But anyway, it's not the point. He impressed me when, during a talk on stage, he pulled a piece of rock out of his pocket and told me in passing that this was a stromatolite, a 3 billion year old sedimentary rock from an Australian desert that has traces of the first life on this planet, frozen in time. Quite impressive, I must say. The guy looked quite peculiar, red leather jacket and long hair tied up, his speech a little reserved, his eyes, though, sparkling with enthusiasm. The man in his 50s, so I guess, impressed me immediately when he talked about his research that life might not have originated in the oceans, but on land. A daring thesis. This encounter left a lasting impression on me, and I began to do a little background research, but couldn't find much about him on the internet. This unsettled me, to be honest. A few days ago, I read the news that his research about the origin of life had been published in the prestigious Nature. Not bad, and well deserved. I mean, if things turn out this way, his way, this would completely revolutionize how we understand the origin of life. The man's name is Dr. Bruce Damer. He's an associate researcher in the Department of Biomolecular Engineering at the University of California at Santa Cruz. If you have the time, check out his work, the search engine of your choice is your friend. Okay, I'm a little off track now, but I didn't want to keep this from you. The guy's just too interesting. Back to our episode today. We have chosen a no less exciting guest for you. Minister of Economy, Minister of Finance by accident, satellite pioneer and chess grandmaster, all gathered in one person. We have chosen Dana because she has a wonderful pioneering spirit and does not allow herself to be diverted from her path. This has earned her homeland, Latvia, the status of a space nation, by the way. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure for me to welcome Dana Reisnice Osola. And I'm so sorry, Dana, I know I'm mispronouncing your name, but what the heck? You're way too cool to take offense. And of course, I couldn't help but talk to her about Queen's Gambit, that incredibly well-done streaming series that is currently taking the chess world by storm and to unprecedented heights. It's the story of Beth, a young chess prodigy. Oh yes, I decided not to put the spoiler alert tag on our little conversation yet. No tricky details whatsoever will be revealed, so don't worry. Marcus, you talk too much. Let's go.
I love the movie because, and I also believe that the people really enjoyed it because the main character was not perfect at all. Yeah. Then for me, it was also especially interesting to watch this factor of chess being used as the weapon of the Cold War. Actually, two of my passions, space and chess, they both have been used as the areas of competition within the period of the Cold War to show that the two big countries are not only strong enough, but they're smart enough, yeah, technologically, intellectually advanced. So, and of course, what I also have to admit, this movie has done so much more for chess, for its prestige, for its popularity, than all the other campaigns we've been trying to do. Yeah, so you can very well see that the movie industry, that's a power. Yeah.
If I remember right, Beth became a grandmaster in chess. You are a grandmaster in chess. So can you fill us in what that is, in fact? So what is a grandmaster?
That's the highest title in it's the like the black belt in judo. Besides the titles, there is, of course, the international rating, ELO, which is used for comparing the strength of chess players. But the title is something that when you do get it, you keep it for the whole life.
To be honest, I could have removed the background noise, but I decided against it. I'll tell you why in a second. If we go back to Queen's Gambit to Beth, when she started to visualize the games on the ceiling, that became all very mystical and magical. So how does that feel in reality?
It is as mysterious as it was portrayed in the Queen's Gambit. And that's the reason why so many people get lost in this world of chess. And some never come back because it somehow indulges you and it sucks you in. It is the totally different world. It is.
What does that mean? What does it mean they don't come back?
They stay in the game for the rest of their lives, and sometimes they mix the reality with the game because the game is so exciting and so much happens during each game. And it's a multi-dimensional and multi-level problem solving that makes your brain occupied, and that's very exciting, yeah.
How many female chess grandmasters are there in comparison to male ones?
I don't know the exact numbers. It's few hundreds, but it is also, chess is also the men's world, the same as politics is. There are several different explanations why it is so, but the numbers of professional chess players are much less than the male ones. Probably also for the practical reasons, because the prizes are higher for the male tournaments and it's easier to make the living. Yes, that's
so. For a tournament, you get less prize money than your male counterparts.
Yes, and this is why fostering the female chess has become one of the top priorities for the International Chess Federation. We want to have more women involved. We want to keep them in the sports. We want them to choose the sports as their profession.
Do you see a difference between male and female chess players? Because in some disciplines in sports, it's obvious that women just lack physical capacity to keep up with a male body, but I think this is not the case for the male and female mind.
Is a very logical question that comes to one's mind when comparing chess to other modes of sport. But I've been asked this question: why is it so that men still play stronger? In general, men play stronger chess than ladies do, and one thing that I was thinking of is that men are able to concentrate on one thing and spend a lot of time digging deeper and deeper, while ladies are better in synthesis of their knowledge, but it's very difficult and viewing the wider area of the game or of the playing field, I would say so. But it's very difficult for a lady to concentrate and really dig deep into the topic. And the best ladies have achieved the highest ranks. They've always had some strong trainers or family members behind. Mm-hmm. People who've been forcing them to go in for more and more chess.
So when has your passion for chess started? If we draw the comparison to Queen's Gambit, Beth was under 10, very young girl. So how was it for you?
Under 10, that's already not a young one to start going in for chess. I started when I was 8, and that's already late for today. But back then, it was more or less okay to start at 8. And I'm a great fan of one of the inheritage of the Soviet system. That's the sports, arts, and music schools networks. That's something that is still existing in Latvia and has been developed and kept strong. That's a network of these schools that gives every child, regardless of their income or regardless of their living place, an opportunity to develop their talents. Yes, and I'm one of the examples. I come from a small town. My family has not been rich, rather opposite. And because of this fact that I was given this opportunity to go Info Chess, I'm here today being the politician, having the opportunity to make my career and success in the life.
Has chess made your work as a politician easier?
Yes, from many aspects, I can say so. First of all, it has been a very important part of my image. As I said, politics is a man's world. And somehow people think that if you're a chess player, you must be smart. And as I've been a young politician, a lady, this harsh man's world that has helped me to open the doors.
So it made it very clear for the men that being a good chess player, that there must be something to you.
Yes, that's right. Then again, that's always been a very good topic to start the discussion with, especially if you meet with other high-ranked politicians. It's always nice to know something more personal about them besides the politics. And then it's much easier to make the contact and come to an agreement on the professional things as well if you have this heat up, not only having the small talk about the weather, but that you can discuss some personal matters. And chess has helped for that. But on the practical side, of course, chess, as any other kinds of sports, gives you such a training that helps you in your life in all the areas. Like, it gives you an experience of very wide spectrum of emotions, starting from the happiness of the victory to the very harsh sorrow of and painful feeling of loss, which is something very normal in politics. And if you know how to lose and how to accept it, how to forget it and still make the next step, still concentrate on your next task, on your next day sometimes, that helps a lot, because you can see that in politics there are a lot of people who do not know how to lose. And
a former American president.
As one nice example here. So sports does teach you also that it is part of the game, being able to lose. It's part of being the champion, yes. And it reminds you and it teaches you that life, politics as well, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. And it's always ups and downs and the period of stagnation that sometimes it is much more difficult to survive or sustain this plateau periods, yes, when you think that you are doing your maximum, but somehow there is no progress, neither regress, yes. And if you've got this experience that this is okay, and it needs you to have the patience and sit on your hands, and the success will come. Yeah. So a lot of aspects, and of course, seeing the playing field, understanding that you are not the only player in the game, that's also something that you have to count with the others, yes? That's something that chess teaches you, that regardless of what you calculate, what you plan yourself, you always do have the opponent and his ideas or her ideas, yes? Mm-hmm. You have to deal with. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. All right, a short break here. I deliberately left these background noises as they are. Any professional would cut that away. That's how you learn it in the podcast and radio world. But rules are here to be broken. I left it in because although if you are a minister of finance or economy and a chess grandmaster on top and, as we'll see in a moment, a satellite pioneer, you're still a human being like you and me with a private life in which things can happen. Like, for example, that children romp through the apartment. That's life. And that's exactly how it should be, don't you think? Back to the show. Let's talk about your political career, which started out by coincidence, if I understand your biography right.
I used to work as the head of High Technology Park. I was trying to develop the space industry in Latvia. I actually did my dream work. And then I was elected in the parliament. Then that was quite shocking for me in the beginning, because as you said, I never really planned to become a politician. But, you know, I've also used to trust the fate or the will of God, whatever you call it, yes. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, I concentrated on my work because I always follow the principle that you have to do maximum in this very time, in this very place where you've been put by fate, yes. And then the way would open, yes, and you would understand what is the next direction you should follow. And it was like already 10 years ago when I entered the politics, and I've been the member of the parliament. I've been the Minister of Economic Affairs and Energy, then the Minister of Finance. And now I'm back again to the parliament in the position of opposition. So a very wide spectrum. I know they're both sides of the game. Mm-hmm.
So that was 10 years ago, you said. You must have been very, very young when you started becoming a minister.
That's right? Probably the advantage and disadvantage of the young democracies. I mean, the advantage in the way that it's easier for the younger people to climb the career ladder.
What does your heart beat for when it comes to things other than politics? You mentioned already the High Technology Park.
Mm-hmm. That was actually, as I said, that was my passion to work on the triple helix principle in the regional development, because it was a city near the seaside, one of the biggest ports in Latvia, very dynamic one. But then again, you have to keep, if you want to be competitive and compete with the very best on the European, on the world's level, you have to find your strong niche. And that's how the idea of the space sector came into our minds, not without the preconditions. That's also the area where the big antennas, also the inheritance of the Soviet Union, are located, next to Ventspils in Irpene, the 32 meters diameter and 16 meters diameter antennas were the inheritance from the Soviet Army infrastructure, which used to be a top secret object during the Soviet times. And when Latvia regained the independence, this object was specially prepared for its transfer to the Latvian state. The special preparation meant the team coming from Russia and destroying everything what they could. The smaller antennas, 8 meters diameter, were dismantled and taken away. The 16 and 32 were just too big to be transported. So they destroyed all the control systems, hoping that this infrastructure would never be used again. But
What was it used for by the Russians?
I'm not sure because what they did use it for, but its capability is, of course, the deep space research observation, yes. But most probably they just used it also for some telecommunication. But then in the early 90s, there were crazy scientists who worked as the engineers in private sector, earned some money, and then spent all their free time to try to reconstruct this infrastructure, and they did it.
Was that a government-funded endeavor, or was that private garage hacking approach?
It was kind of government funded, but back then the government was very poor and the funding allocated for science was very low. And that's why I'm telling that the salaries these scientists got were extremely low and they were forced to work and do something else.
And be creative.
And be creative. Yeah, that's right.
And what happened to those antennas?
Currently, those two antennas are operational. The big one is used for deep space research, and the smaller one, they also participate in different programs for the small satellite signal processing. And also as the part of the infrastructure for the study process, since electronics IT, that's two of the areas that Ventspils University has been developing, and they use space as the potential and interesting and exciting sector to get the students interested in. Because you can, if you think of the regional university, how can it be competitive if compared to the capital, then it has to provide something more exciting or a niche skills. Sure. that would attract the students. And space has been one of those areas how the people have been attracted to the place.
So the origin of Ventspils High Technology Park were those observation, those satellite dishes from the Russians, and then a technology park established itself around this. Is that right?
Yes, around the concept that we provided and we are still providing the physical infrastructure for the companies that need the physical territory with state-of-the-art infrastructure, good connections, and there is a logistics center, while there is the railway, the port, the airport, all the infrastructure that is needed for the businesses. The university preparing the human resources and providing the research, and then this radio astronomy center with the antennas as the additional specialization that both trains the students, goes in for research and provides the research that is necessary for the industry as well.
So at some point you became the head of this high technology park. And so, of course, you had the opportunity to decide in what direction to go. And at the end of it resulted the first Latvian satellite. Is that the whole story told in a very brief and dense nutshell?
That is the whole story told, because we understood that besides this fundamental research with the deep space sector that's strong, and our researchers are involved in the international networks, something more practical would be needed. So that's how we got to this idea of building the first Latvian satellite. And then we found the partners, which was OEB Technologies and Bremen Applied University. That was the cooperation project between Latvia and Germany. So in the process of building the satellite, if it was also used as the very nice platform for studying purpose, yes, for the both professors and the students who were involved in the process, they got the unique skills that had never been available in Latvia before then.
So what was the satellite good for? I take it was a little more than just Sputnik orbiting the Earth. So there was some scientific interest in it, right?
Several purposes of the satellite. One of that was testing the new AIS, automatic identification system antenna. Second, one of the optical cameras that was built in Latvia was tested its operation in space. And the third one, it was a new plug-and-play modem, which was developed in cooperation with the Swedish commercial partners. These were the main payloads for the satellite. And then, so of course, the second satellite signal processing for the students using the antennas located in Ventspils.
For the satellite trackers out there amongst our audiences, its name is Venta 1.
One, yes.
Okay. So
Venta, that's the third biggest river in Latvia. Venta is also part of Ventspils. It is the the city called Castle on Venta River. And Viens, or one, that means that the others are to follow, hopefully.
Just to get a feeling, when was the first launch? When did Venta 1 launch?
Was it four years ago?
In how far has that changed Latvia's role in space?
I wouldn't say that it has changed the Latvia's role in space so much. I think it has changed the role of space in Latvia. Because that's also been one of the factors motivating Latvia to become the associated partner of the European Space Agency. Before that, and that was also one of my initiatives, me and my colleagues from Ventspils, we've been advocating for Latvia entering the international space industry and sector in general. This year is historical that we have shifted from the PEC status to the associated partner already. So, which has given the chance for the Latvian industry and research institutions to find their place in the industry as well. The volumes are not too big yet, but I think that the companies have understood that this is a very nice niche, especially for such a small country like Latvia is. We ought to concentrate on value-added sectors where not so much human resources are required. And this is an area with a great potential, as it has proved already in practical projects as well.
So what do you think could be a potential future niche for Latvia when it comes to space engagement?
Oh, I'm not sure that there's something that the other countries do not do, but some of the areas that our companies do provide and the research institutions do provide is the isolation materials. That's some capacity that lasts already from the Soviet times. The radiation resistant circuit boards, the very precise atomic clocks that are to be used in ESA space missions. Mm-hmm. The heat transmission services, a la term, and there's such a company mm-hmm. that would participate in HERA mission. So the minor niche products that can be provided by our companies and research institutions, that's, I think, the approach.
You know what? I find it always fascinating that you guys in the Northern European countries, you must have some secret sauce, some whatever magic to your countries, because you're always one step ahead of the rest of Europe. So, of course, the world only talks about Sweden and Finland and Norway when it comes to education or social experiments. But I mean, like, take Latvia as a small country now having its own space program, or I mean, like, all when it comes to digitalization of countries and being on the forefront of future thinking. So what is it that's so special? What makes you guys so
it's
special?
It's the size, I guess. It's the size, because in order to be competitive, either you have to do something totally different than the others do, or you can do the same, just a bit faster than the others. And here the size matters. If you come from a smaller country, I think it's somehow easier to take the decisions and to be flexible and to change adapt to changes. You don't have the scale in the economies of scale, of course. It's a very important factor. But on the other hand, you are much more flexible. Yeah? So that's
interesting.
That's like being a smart and then fast and dynamic amphibia among the big ships that might become Titanics, yes.
So how many inhabitants does Latvia have?
A bit less than 2 million. Probably it's, you mean another factor that forces our people to move faster, it is, of course, the level of welfare. If you the wealthier you are, the lazier you become. Yes, and vice versa.
A very wise observation. Thank you for that. So who was your launcher? Who was your carrier for the satellite? Was it the Russians, or do you talk about
it? It was India. It was PSLV. There were,
okay.
We started with PSLV. Then since there was an idea to put some US components on the satellite, because of the US restrictions, we had to quit this idea. Then we had the agreement with Falcon, which was delayed. And then we also wanted to use the opportunity with Soyuz. But finally, after the big retour, we came back to PSLV.
How does Russia feel about your endeavors?
I'm not sure. I don't think it's that important at this point.
Okay. It's a small country.
Small country and small space endeavors.
All right. All right. Dana, you have a degree in international from the International Space University in France. Can you talk a little bit about that? What made you go to that university in the first place? Because before that, you were a very talented chess player. And at some point, you ended up at a space university. So what happened?
At that point, I used to work in Ventspils High Technology Park, and space had become my passion. And because of this radio astronomy center, I got interested in it, and I thought that I would also want to continue my education. And then somehow, I don't remember how, I found out about this space program, which I thought was just perfect, because that's the way, that's the future education that was the system that was provided by the ISU, because it's transsectoral education that they proposed there. It's not just space in the technical way or space management or space law. It's a combination of these. And that was something that I got excited about. And the people from different backgrounds were studying there. The space companies, engineers that struggled with the space law and management, and vice versa, the people with the soft skills that got crazy trying to understand this engineering part. But that was something that actually seemed fascinating to me. Yes. Mm-hmm. And you know that the innovation always happens on the crossroads of different areas. And I think this is one way out to also force people think in a more innovative way. If you put together people from different areas, from different sectors with different backgrounds.
I could imagine that space management is a highly valuable degree these days, especially when it comes to the rebirth of space. Space is a thing again. We had the early days of space, we had the Apollo days, but now we're experiencing a completely new era because the technology is ready to take care of safe transportation. And so many things are starting to move. So perhaps you have a very valuable degree in that sector. How do you see what is going on at the moment when it comes to the Artemis program, the Mars endeavors, Blue Origin, SpaceX, ESA, for example? How does that resonate with you?
ESA is playing a big role, but what my feeling is that ESA, Europe in general, should more get oriented to the moon. The latest missions, we've seen so many missions now to Mars, but we've lost our grasp on the moon while China is not sleeping. Yes, and I think this is one area which we shouldn't be missing. And
I have the impression that the moon is a given. So this is just a technical thing to do within a certain time span, but this shouldn't be an issue or a challenge anymore. The next moon, so to say, is Mars to humanity.
Yes and no, because this is the attraction of space. It always urges you to go further. And of course, it's the natural goal to conquer the Mars. But on the other hand, space is still a field that's kind of a, you know, still the geopolitical issue as well. And I don't think that we should forget about this territory and let the other parts of the world or the globe take over.
Say, Dana, let's go back to ESA. What's going on with ESA in comparison to other spacefaring nations or collaborations of nations? Because, I mean, like, ESA is so underselling itself when it comes to public appearance as opposed to the actual scientific achievements. Because ESA has so many successful missions under their belt. And in public, people are still wearing NASA t-shirts. So what is going on here? Why are Europeans not capable to market themselves?
I don't know, but it's half a joke. But at some point, I've been thinking of how to increase the patriotism of the Europeans for Europe. And I think here the movie industry might help. At some point, I was joking that the same as US has their Hollywood, we should found our or establish our Eurovood, because these kind of the film industry, everything that comes with it, that helps to spread the word. Because otherwise, if you're just talking or trying to explain the complicated scientific missions, there's a limited number of people who would understand that. The same as with chess. I mean, this one movie has done so much more, Queen's Gambit, for chess, for its image. The sales of the chess boards have skyrocketed over the last few weeks. I think it's the same for space in Europe, because there's so many countries forming the European Union, being the members of ESA. But on the other hand, there's no clear sense of ownership of this structure and the results. Who would be the ones who would be boasting about the results? Some institution. It doesn't touch the hearts, because we are patriots of our country, of something that we feel belonging to. But once again, for US, for Russians, it is emotional. Yeah, it's a part of the bigger story. It's the attribute. Being able to conquer space, it's an attribute of the strength of this big country. While, as you said, for Europe, it's like very practical, very pragmatic. We have to be advanced in the technology. That's rational. That's not emotional. But
that's
emotions is the thing that touches the hearts of the people, that allows you to believe in the thing. Yes.
Speaking of emotions, did you have any emotional moments in that respect?
Oh, I mean, watching the launch of our satellite, even though I was not able to be there in India due to my ministerial position, I was not able to just leave for several weeks while it was not clear which date it would really be launched. But I was waking up in the night, I think it was, I don't know, early morning, and while the others were still sleeping after our midsummer festival, which is the big holidays in Latvia, I was just following the launch and counting the seconds, and the heart was trembling, and that's such a strong physical feeling. You can find this only in sports. But then then I had this feeling that, yes, that was worth. I mean, spending so many hours fighting so much against the opponents of the whole idea of developing space in Latvia and trying to raise the money and everything. But that was very emotional. Of course, it could fly also without me following, but this was one of the momentum, yes. I understand that it's worth doing that, yeah.
I mean, like, you were part of it, and without you, this thing wouldn't have been flying the way it flew, because you were a part of that and you fought for it. So I think this is when we're now gravitating slowly back towards you being a chess player. I mean, this is a victory you're celebrating here, right?
Of course. What's it is really strange. Like, you were asking what next, what shall be next after conquering Mars.
Indeed, I asked this, but it didn't make it into the final version. I asked Dana what we do once we make it to Mars. What comes after that?
I think it's the same with every victory, at least for me in chess. It has been like this. Whenever you win a tournament, I don't feel this sense of happiness, rather of emptiness, because then I've got this urge or this strange feeling of aiming at something new and finding the next goal. That's probably the personal characteristic or feature of my character, but this is something that, yeah, when you have this feeling of victory, that's rather a sad feeling, because you've achieved something and you have to find another goal. But that's the factor for the progress, no?
A personal question, what state are you in right now? Is it a state of emptiness, or... Where are you right now?
State of accumulating the strength for the next victories.
Nice. And that is, what are you building up your strength for?
Let's see. For the next episode of your podcast. In some time.
You just made a perfect cliffhanger to keep us excited about our next conversation. At the end of our show, we ask our guests to share something, a very personal moment, a moment of inspiration about science or technology or whatever they want to talk about. So what is it that you would like to share with us, with me, with our listeners, without much thinking about science, technology, maybe space travel, but not necessarily?
My very strong feeling that impressed me was actually the first time when I saw the real satellite being built in OHB clean room. Because normally you think of a satellite being something very distant. You are just looking at in the pictures or in the movies. But then when you saw this object in the same room where you are, and you tried to grasp that the human beings have developed something like this. Yes, this was somehow very emotional for me as well. That just shows the potential of our brain capacity.
I can totally understand you, because I get really emotional about the sheer thought that this piece of technology will be floating in space.
Yes.
All alone, forever. And so, I mean, like, if you take the Voyager probes, for example, they are out there right now as we speak. They've been out there for 40 years, wherever they go. And I think calculations tell us that they will be out there for thousands of years still. The way they were designed by human hands. And they will potentially be around when the Earth is not around anymore. And there's still technology around then. And this is something that chills me to my bones in a very positive way.
And the second thing, you know, when I looked at the Hubble telescope photos, that's something also that made me think of, I don't know how many years ago it was when I first saw the pictures, yes. It made me think of the thing that there is God in there, yeah. Mm-hmm. Or out there. Mm-hmm. Mm. That's something divine and universal.
Because it's too big for us to fathom. And this is why we're trying to fill that gap with a divine explanation or if there's no divine explanation, we're trying to fill it with science or whatnot.
But in general, one of the major things that space and space exploration gives to the human being, it is a reminder that we, the human beings, we are not the crown of the universe. It gives a totally different perspective, and you can see that you are such a minor, very important, but such a minor part of this universe.
Which figure are humans on the chessboard? Which one?
The knight. The most dynamic piece, which makes the unexpected moves.
Wonderful. Thank you, Dana. That was absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Marcus. It was a pleasure.
What a career. Of course, it would be obvious to lock oneself up now in one's apartment and spend the rest of one's life as a couch potato out of frustration. But hey, honestly, I'm glad that there are people like Dana. She gives hope. Especially with the line that won't leave me, the wealthier you are, the lazier you become. I guess there's something to that. Thank you all out there for being here today. If you want more space news, don't forget to sign up for the Space Watch Global newsletter. And if you want to leave us a message, write us at podcast@spacewatch.global. I look forward to seeing you next time. So long, my friends.